Guys, I've got this brand sponsor who sort of insists that I do this, right? And it's rule 62. Don't take yourself so damn seriously, right? And see, guys, I got to remember that, I don't know anything about nothing ever. So, I get to have fun. We absolutely insist on enjoying life, right? But guys, I have a sobriety date. It's September the 7th of 2015. And in that very, very short amount of time, there's been no need or obsession to pick up a drink or a drug. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, as you know, and I sponsor sponsors. And this one time I complained about a GSR meeting. So now I have a service sponsor. So I beg of you to be very, very careful what you complain to your sponsor about. And my sponsor just texted me and he said, don't suck. I might know these people. So, guys, if I suck, don't tell my sponsor. I have a home group. It's known as the Global Main Purpose Group. We meet Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. and we go through the big book. But due to the power of amends, I get to live on the beautiful, beautiful island of Bermuda. And if you find yourself on my beautiful island, either coming in, on a cruise or to one of the resorts, and you want to go to a meeting, please, please, please let me know. I am more than happy to take you to a meeting or make arrangements for you to be taken to a meeting. Sunny, thank you so much for asking me to speak and for this group for hosting. It's always an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, even speak. But guys, I would be remiss if I didn't say something to my beautiful, beautiful friend, France, who's on this meeting. She is celebrating 37 years of continuous sobriety today. So congratulations, my friend. Guys, what you're going to hear is 100% my experience, my truth and my reality, both in the program and while I was in active alcoholism. See, I can only share with you my experience, right? I'm a fellow traveler on this journey, and I don't profess to know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, or God, right? I don't know anything about the steps. For me, AA stands for action and accountability. And oh boy, we're going to be talking about action and accountability with respect to fear and sex, especially in the fourth and the fifth steps, right? So if you don't mind, I'm going to start with sex first. I know it comes after fear in the big book, but in my experience, sex causes a lot of fear, right? It's like, oh crap, I'm late. So there's fear in that. Anyway, that's a whole different thing. I'm going to preface this by saying that this is my experience with the inventory, right? Both as a sponsee and as a sponsor. And I can't address a lot of other things around this because I don't have any experience with it, right? So when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about sex between two, three, four, five, I don't care, whatever. Consenting adults, right? If your experience is different, if your experience has trauma in it, I'm really, really sorry about that. Please, please, please reach out to me after this meeting so that we can discuss it. I have some sexual assault in my story, and I had to inventory that differently than what I want to share about today. Now, our big book makes it very, very clear that sex is God-given, right? And therefore good, right? Sex has two primary functions: procreation, right? Having babies, which is something I am really, really good at, by the way. I have six kids, 12 imaginary grandchildren. See, my kids seem to like the other sex function, which is pleasure. And there's no resentment on my behalf at all, right? That I've got 12 imaginary grandchildren. You see, and I truly believe that God gave us orgasms. If God didn't want us to have orgasms, he wouldn't have given us this really, really great, sexual outlet. But the book also gives us the measure, this threshold question, right? Was it selfish? Did it cause bitterness, suspicion, jealousy? See, those are the questions that I need to ask when I'm doing my sex inventory. Now, the sex inventory has very little to do with the actual intercourse, right? The mechanics of sex are absolutely irrelevant, for the most part, right? It's about the relationship. It's about the people involved. It's about the motivation, right? I don't care how your vagina accidentally impaled someone's penis, right? As long as it was consensual. And as long as nobody else was hurt in that exchange. You see, I still don't understand how that happens because I've been told, right? People will say to me, well, I accidentally slipped on, and it's like, I don't know that how that happens, right? It's not like we're all jostling at a football game trying to exit at the end, right? And we're all bumping into each other. Oh, the book uses the word, the phrase shoulder to shoulder. That now that takes on a whole new meaning for me. We're jostling shoulder to shoulder. But the book makes it very clear that we are not the arbiters of anyone's sexual conduct, right? You do whatever you want with your genitals. That's none of my business, right? I don't care what you do with them as long as it doesn't cause harm to other people. And I'm not talking about in the BDSM way, right? I'm talking about harms to relationships, harms to people. And the book says that you know, we can have bland or pepper sex a diet, right? And that there are all these different variations in between. And I'm cool with that. I don't really care. Now, guys, I've been married for 35 years to the same man. And I have never once stepped out on my husband. I've never had affairs. I've never been anything. There's been never anything inappropriate. And I thought when I was, you know, tasked with this part of my inventory that I'm going to breeze right through it, right? There's nothing really to put down in this inventory. Here's what I discovered, however. Although my marriage isn't selfish, right? I can be very selfish and manipulating in really specific cases, right? I use sex to manipulate and control my husband into all sorts of thinking, into all sorts of things, whether I'm drinking or whether I'm sober, right? And the conversation usually goes something like this. Hey, sweetheart, if you buy me these Jimmy Choo shoes, I'll give you a blowjob every day this week, right? And his eyes usually perk right up and he thinks this is a great deal. Now, I usually don't follow through with the deal and he gets annoyed or worse, he gets disappointed. You see, guys, I use sex as a weapon, as a power play to manipulate my husband into doing what I want, right? The marriage isn't selfish, but the conniving and the manipulation is, right? The question is, does it cause jealousy? Yeah, sometimes, right? Does it cause suspicion? Yes. He begins to think that, you know, every sex act is connected to some kind of transaction, right? Does it cause bitterness? Sure. Especially when he thinks he's able to collect on the deal and I renege, right? Guys, my husband and I were in graduate school. And, you know, we always knew we wanted children. And I started to put the pressure on him. And he said, well, you know what? We'll have children when we graduate. I was still 3 or 4 years down the road. And I decided I wanted a baby right now. So what do you think I did, right? I came off the pill and I poked holes in all the condoms. And guess what? I got pregnant immediately, right? I was delighted, right? He was confused. He couldn't figure out how it happened. We were using birth control. No, we weren't. You see, I manipulated intercourse to coincide with ovulation, right? He just thought he was getting lucky, but I was manipulating all of that, see? And I had to make amends for that, right? Imagine what that looked like. So see, guys, we had 6 kids in 5 years, right? And in my head, I thought, you know what? 8 kids would be perfect, perfect. He didn't think so. And he decided he couldn't trust me with birth control. So he got a vasectomy. And I was so angry about it. It still ended up on my anger inventory 25 years later. How dare he, right? How dare he control me? And how dare he control my wants and my desire to have more children? You see, I didn't realize that I pushed him into that decision because I used sex to manipulate him. Was it selfish? The vasectomy? Yes, but that's another question, right? Was I being selfish? Yes, absolutely, right? I was using my actions to intentionally get pregnant by poking holes in condoms. That's selfish. Did my behavior arouse suspicion? Oh my God, yes, right? How does she get pregnant so often, right? We're taking precautions. Does it arouse jealousy? Well, perhaps when we compared ourselves to those other couples who were normal and spaced their kids out every couple of years, right? Did it cause bitterness? Absolutely, right? We didn't have any money. We were graduate students and we were living in 400 square feet with 4 children under the age of 3. There were a set of twins in there. I can also use sex as punishment, right? He didn't do something I wanted, so now I'm going to withhold sex, right? Selfish, self-seeking. And what's worse is when I want sex and he doesn't, right? How do I behave and what do? Right? When I rebuff him, he usually goes away to sulk, but he respects my decision. When I'm denied, right? I go cray cray, right? I can't understand why he doesn't want to make love to me. You know, I don't consider he might be tired or stressed or not feeling well, right? I want what I want when I want it, right? Without regard or consideration to him, right? See, my alcoholism is problematic even when I'm not drinking, right? Is it selfish? Yes, absolutely. Does it arouse suspicion? Yes. Jealousy? Yes. Bitterness? Absolutely. See, guys, I'm also guilty of using sex to diffuse tension, right? If we've had a fight or he's upset with me for some reason, I spent too much money on shoes, I'll do my best to sweet talk him and seduce him, right? And I know from experience, he's usually in a much better mood after sex. But again, it's me manipulating him, right? Manipulating him to get what I want. I don't want to take responsibility for my action, for something that I've done to annoy or anger him. So I use sex as a weapon for my benefit. Is it selfish? Yes. Does it arouse suspicion or jealousy or bitterness? Yes, of course it does, right? Now, in my younger years, right, I would get all dressed up to, I would go out with cleavage cut down to here. Who was I really trying to impress? What was my motivation? Well, in retrospect, as a result of doing this inventory, right, my motivation was to vicariously garner male attention, right? That male attention in itself was self-seeking. It made me feel better about myself, right? It was this lie that I continued to perpetuate, right? Was it selfish? Yes, right? Did it arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Yes, absolutely. So, much to my chagrin, I do a nightly written inventory and I send it to my sponsor. And in that inventory, even to today, I indicate sexual harms and manipulation, right? Even though I'm aware of it today, I still fall into old habits, right? And I will tell my sponsor about the deal I made for shoes. And if I don't make good on my promises, my sponsor will reach out to my husband. And my sponsor and my husband chat. Right? And that's so wrong on so many levels, but it keeps me accountable, right? Because this is a program of action and accountability. My word means something today. I'm much better at making deals, right? It's no longer, oh, if you buy me this, I'll give you this for a whole year, right? I've learned maybe just for tonight or just for the weekend, right? I learned that if I bargain, I still have to fulfill my end of the transaction, whatever it happens to be. As I said earlier, the sex inventory is about relationships, right? So if you're single, a consenting adult, and you meet somebody who's single and you get it on at the, in the toilet stall at the football game, good for you, right? But if you're married with kids at home and you're getting it on in the stall with your husband or your wife sitting in the stadium cheering on their team, we're inadvertently hurting relationships and individuals. And when I take people through the work, I often ask them, who did you harm in this exchange? Oh, well, nobody. Really? What about him? Was he married? Maybe. Maybe? Yeah, well, I don't know. I didn't ask. Ah. So not only did you possibly harm your relationship or your marriage, you may have harmed, his wife, his kids. And even though it may have been clandestine or clandestine, and no one found out, what about STDs or pregnancy, right? Now, this is a really, really specific example. I work with a lot of people. I've taken a lot of fifth steps. This one really sort of stands out in my head. So I was working with this woman and she was single and she hooked up with a married man. And there was a transmission of an STD from her to him. And he gave it to his wife, who then gave it to their child during childbirth. So, we're often not aware of the damage or harm we do to other people emotionally, physically, spiritually, right? And this woman liked married men because she was. Because they were unable to commit to her and she enjoyed them for her benefit. Again, it comes down to manipulation, right? She used married men to satisfy this deep spiritual malady deep within her, right? It's all based on motives. And I believe that the Big Book uses the word motives like six times, right? On page 70, it says something to the effect that it depends on us and our motives. On page 86, again, in the morning prayer, it asks us before we begin our day, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives, Right. I also think somewhere on that same page, on page 86, it says that our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. And in working with others, it says, keep on the firing line. Keep on the firing line with these motives, and God will keep you safe. And you know, that's talking about, you know, doing the next right thing and working with newcomers, going to the most sordid places on earth. But it comes down to motives. What is it that I'm trying to achieve? Is it about me? Am I being self-seeking, wanting just for me, or am I trying to help you? Somewhere in the 12 and 12 and in the 10th step, it says something to the effect that in other instances, only the closest scrutiny will reveal what our true motives are, right? See, guys, I am really, really grateful to have inventory to carefully examine my motives for manipulation, for harm, for connivingness, for selfishness and self-seeking, right? And page 69 of our book gives us our directions, right? It's the first full paragraph on page 69. It says, we reviewed our own conduct over the past years. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where were we at fault? And what should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it, right? See, I get to list these things. I get to look at it. I send it to a sponsor who reviews it, an objective third party. You see, today I can usually catch myself trying to make a bargain or make transactional deals for sex. Not always, but it's better, right? And the book tells me that I need to subject each relation or each situation to this test, right? Was it selfish or not? And then here's the sex prayer that I use. I ask God to mold my ideals, right? To help me live up to them. And I have to remember that my sex powers, right? Which I think I have lots of, by the way. No, I'm just kidding. Are good and not to be used lightly or selfishly or to be despised or loathed, right? These are wonderful connections that we have between people. But I must be willing to grow towards those ideals, right? What are those ideals? And everybody has their own. Everybody has their own sense of what they want it to be. You know, my sex ideals are different than other people. You know, for me, fidelity is an important principle, right? That's not always the case for other people, but for me, it is. And so I need to, you know, ask God what I should do about each individual matter. And the right answer will come if and only if I want it. You see, today my husband is aware of my tendencies and my behavior. And my sponsor knows all of that too. And now you guys too, right? There are absolutely no secrets in this. And then on page 70, the second full sentence, second full paragraph, it says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for strength to do the right thing, right? That's another sex prayer. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. We think of their needs and we work for them, right? This takes us out of ourselves and it quiets the imperious urge to yield when it would mean heartache. And then page 89 of the book, right, tells me that practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail, right? So frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. So when I can't figure something out, right, when I can't get a hold of my sponsor, when in my head I'm conniving and doing all sorts of crazy things, well, guess what I should do? Well, I should go out and help a newcomer until I can figure it out. And in the doing so, in the meantime, not make any sex bargains, right? Like, if you buy me this, if you buy me a brand new bauble, I'll do X, Y, and Z, right? See, I don't get to do that today. You know, my husband is coming home from Bermuda tonight, right? And I am sure there will be a wonderful romantic exchange, but it's not predicated on any kind of transaction. Right? It's the nurturing love that we have been able to develop over the course of our marriage and through sobriety and through step work. I'm running out of time, aren't I? No, I got time. 10 minutes? All right. All right. So let's go back to fear then. All right. So on page 67, it says that fear, right, somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread, and it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, right? But didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? We reviewed our fears thoroughly, right? We put them down on paper. But unlike other inventories, right, this is not something that I find myself based on character defects. This is about self-reliance. This is about me not trusting God, right? And for me, fear is born out of three things. Losing something I have, not getting something I want, or somebody finding out about something I've done or not done. Now, there are fears that we have that are natural and born within us in efforts to keep us alive, right? Most people are afraid of heights. Why? Well, because we don't have wings. We can't fly. And terminal velocity will kill us when we hit the bottom, right? You know, if I were to jump off like 30, like Rockefeller Center, you know what? That sudden stop at the bottom is going to kill me, right? So most people have a fear of heights. Most people have a fear of water. Why? Well, because we don't have gills. We can't breathe underwater. And drowning is a real problem. Most people are afraid of snakes and creepy crawly things. Why? Because those things bite and they kill us, right? Most of us are somehow afraid of the dark. Why? Well, because there are things that live in the dark that want to eat us, right? Saber-toothed tigers or whatever, right? So we're born with innate fears. And as long as those fears are not irrational, as long as those fears don't keep us from living our lives the best way that we can, right, they're appropriate. Now, I'm going to tell you, I have an irrational fear of water. It's crazy. And part of it, I've come to learn through inventory, is because I saw the movie Jaws when I was a kid, and then I watched Piranha when I was a kid, right? Now I don't go in the water. And the irony of my life is that as an adult, I have always lived within 5 miles of an ocean, right? Out in California, here in Connecticut, and Bermuda is an island. Water is everywhere, right? So I didn't swim. I didn't put my toe in water, bath water, salt water, lake water, you name it. When I turned 50, my sisters and I went to Hawaii, and I went to meetings on the beach, and there on the beach, there was this wonderful man said, "Hey, you know, I got a friend and he takes people out to go snorkeling with the manta rays. You should do it." Oh, hell no, not doing it. Meanwhile, I took the pamphlet back and I put it on the bureau in the hotel. My sister saw it. My sister's like, "Oh, we're going to do that." And I went, "Have fun. I'm not going." They said, "Yeah, you got to come too, because you know this guy." Right. So what do? I go to this page in the book, right? And it tells me what to do. It says, we ask God to remove our fear and to direct our attention to what he would have us be. And at once we commence to outgrow fear. Well, let me tell you something. It wasn't quite that easy, right? So my sisters had to talk me into it. My sponsor said, go. So I went, and we get to the place, and they put you in a dry suit, right? So that's like trying to squeeze me into sausage casing, right? Things are bulging, and my sisters are tall and thin, so they look great. And then we put on our flippers and they try on our masks, and everything worked. We get on the boat. Right? And it's getting dark and I can see the bottom, and we're floating out. And, you know, I'm terrified. And we get to our designated spot. There's this little platform, and it's a square, and it's got these little handlebars, and everybody's getting into the water, and I'm sitting on the edge, and I'm like, oh my God, 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 I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. And at that moment, I said, dear God, please give me the strength. And the captain of the boat pushed me in the water, right? At that exact same moment. So I'm falling in the water. There's water getting into my snorkel, right? My sisters are there to help me. The guide knew I was terrified of water. They set me up on the little handlebars. They put pool noodles under my feet and under my legs and under my hips. And I'm just floating and I'm holding on and I'm looking straight down. I'm going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. God, please help me, right? All of a sudden the lights go on. All the plankton start showing up. And these manta rays come, big, magnificent beasts with mouths this big. Now, intellectually, I knew that they only eat plankton, right? They can't eat me, but that's not what my fear is saying. And these things are swarming around, and slowly but surely I'm focused on these animals, these beautiful marine animals. And this one kept touching me. She kept hitting my shoulder. And I'd screech. And they told us, they won't touch you. They won't touch you. She kept touching me, right? And before long, I'm mesmerized by this experience. They turn off the lights. The guide says, that's it. It's time to get out. 90 minutes had passed and I'm underwater looking at these amazing beings, right? It says, what would God have us be? God wants me to be a mother, a daughter, a sister, right? God wants me to interact in my life. You see, God gives me these opportunities to confront my fears, right? I don't always go willingly. Right? But if I ask for the strength, something happens. Something happens. You know, somebody pushing me in the water. You know, these big manta rays touching me, and the guide said, you know what? They don't touch people. There must have been something about you that she really liked. Yeah, I was terrified. That's what she liked, right? So my point is that we have all sorts of fears, but I can't. Live, I can't sit and huddled in paralysis because of that fear. I need to confront it. I'm going to the Cayman Islands in a couple of weeks. Guess what? We're going snorkeling again, right? And it's going to be the same kind of fear. I'm going to sit there on the boat and someone's going to push me in the water, right? Reggie's brother is going to push me in the water. And you know, someone's going to hold my hand and I'm going to get through it. And I'm going to be able to be a responsible, healthy, sober woman. And I get to share these experiences. And it makes me sound like a moron, right? It makes me sound like I'm a big baby, but I'm not the only one. You know, guys, I flew helicopters for a living. And I'm so terrified of water that I would vector around large bodies of water and get yelled at by my boss, right? You're wasting fuel, you're wasting fuel. Yeah. But what happens if I crash, right? I'm okay to crash and burn on land, but I don't want to hit the water and drown, right? Or if I'm crossing over like the Hudson River, I'll make sure I have enough altitude. So if I have an engine failure, I'm going to land. I can auto rotate on the other side and land on land, right? This whole idea of, you know, the miracle on the Hudson, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm not landing in water. I would rather take myself out by crashing on the ground. So guys, you know, this is really, really powerful, right? And at once we commence to outgrow fear. And for me, my experience, I only outgrow fear 30 seconds at a time, right? I'm still terrified of water, but in those moments, right, I get that pause, right, that I get in the 11th step. That pause gives me just enough time to breathe, to regroup, to ask God for strength, to ask God to direct or to ha what He would have me be. What does he want me to be? He wants me to be present, wants me to have these experiences so that I can be a better wife, mother, daughter, sister, sponsor, friend, right? That I can share these experiences because fear runs, you know, book says I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. And I think with that, I am done, right? All right, guys, thank you so much. It's always so much fun to come and see you guys. And I hope any of that, some of that made sense. Mwah! Thanks so much.